Hey, everybody. Gordon Chavez from GordonChavez.com, GordonChavez.tv, and now GordonChavez.radio. This is the second episode of the radio show. I have a special guest here with me today. This is, before I tell you her name, let me tell you a little bit about her. So she started out teaching in middle school and high school of mathematics. She has taught in here in the United States as well as in Chile. She's taught in private schools and public schools and I believe charter schools as well. And from there, she has gone on to becoming a teacher of teachers. So she doesn't just teach. She teaches our teachers. She teaches our administrators and people like that. And so she has been a guest lecturer at various university events, teaching events, as well as winning the National Inspired Changemaker Award that was given to her by the Yale, I believe, Center for Emotional Intelligence, as well as Facebook. It's a partnership between the two. Mm-hmm. And so emotional intelligence is a big part of what she does. She currently is working with a company called Think Circa that also teaches administrators. They go into our school systems and teach our teachers basically how to improve. Her goal is to encourage social action through teaching with real world experience with her students. And so, Dr. Mona Kiani, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it is a great pleasure. So let's get into kind of what we're going to talk about. I want to talk about education today because that is what you work in. That's your expertise. But more so than that, I feel like it makes such a huge impact on society. Our kids go into schools from age 5 to age 18 and then higher education after that. And they're being taught and taken care of by other people, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're spending, 4, 5, 6 hours a day with other people. And we are trusting these people to teach our kids good things. And, our system has done a decent job for the most part, but it seems like there's either now or it's been for a while, there's room for improvement, mm-hmm. room for an evolution. So what would you like to say about that, I guess, in general?
Yeah. Well, I currently work for a company called Think Circa. We're based out of Chicago. We're a digital literacy platform that teaches critical thinking. Okay. So if you go back to your days of being in elementary, middle, high school, we weren't necessarily taught how to critically think. Mm-hmm. We were taught how to obtain information and essentially regurgitate it the way that the teacher wanted to see it.
Yeah.
And so we're noticing with all this information being at our fingertips, with the, invention of all the technology that we have just in the palms of our hands, we're no longer in need of simply memorizing facts and then spitting them back out. So this concept of critically thinking about something is the new way of advancing education because, again, that information is already there. And so one of the focuses, really, if you take a look at CIRCA, it's actually an acronym. So okay. Think CIRCA is an acronym. CIRCA stands for making a claim. So C is for claim. Mm-hmm. So thinking about whatever the issue is, what's your claim about that? Mm-hmm. And then E is for evidence. So what evidence do you have to support your claim?
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've given you the evidence, I've got to explain my thinking or my reasoning. So that's the R. What's my reasoning mm-hmm. behind using that evidence to support my claim?
Mm-hmm.
And that second C in CIRCA is counter argument. So now I want to actually look at what are all the opposing viewpoints to my claim? What are the counterclaims? Let me address those counterarguments.
Mm-hmm.
And then that A in CIRCA stands for audience. So who am I speaking to or writing to, making sure I'm using audience appropriate language?
Okay.
So this is a framework that can be used no matter if you're in school or in your workplace, whether you're in your relationships, no matter if you're in math class, social studies, Spanish, PE, or you're just in the principal's office getting in trouble for something, it's important to be able to communicate your ideas.
Okay.
Now, one of the things I really appreciate about the approach that Think Circa has taken is really bringing in not just critical thinking, but as you're looking at other points of view, that empathy piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so bringing in a lens on empathy and how our world could use a lot more of that. So considering counter arguments, empathizing, and then using that to make an informed decision and not just seeing it as binary. There are lots of different kind of facets to the truth. And so the more we're looking at it at different angles, we can arrive at the whole truth. Mm-hmm. And then another piece of this is communication. So if you think about, okay, great, I'm able to critically think, I'm able to empathize and use that as I come up with my thought on something. Well, how do we communicate that? So many of our issues nowadays actually have to do with miscommunication. And so through Think Circa, we're looking at how do you communicate through writing, speaking, and listening. And so these are some of the things that we also, you know, incorporate as part of our mission vision of the company, but also in the trainings we do and in that, in the platform, the online tool. And it's really appropriate to have an online tool to execute all these things as we see kind of the digital age and the, just that tech literacy really needing to be a part of what we do in the future.
Wow.
So that's a little bit about what the company, what we're out to do as a company. And I got to use Think Circa in my classroom as a math teacher. And one of my favorite parts of it was actually the way I was able to bring the real world into my classroom with such a tool. The specific lesson that I was using was looking at, you know, what's the best path after high school? And you and I have talked about this a bit as you have four children and you're kind of always as a parent looking at the climate of education and is college even really the way to go nowadays. And it was very different back in our age, in our day. And so needing to kind of think outside the box of what is the future actually going to look like? And this particular lesson I did in my math classroom, the essential question was, what's the best option for this student, Javier, who was looking to kind of map out his future? And so we went through kind of a mathematical process to calculate, but really to think about all aspects of life, not just the financial outcome of your life, but also your happiness. And also, you know, the connection you want to have to other humans. Do I want to live close to home, close to my family? What impact do I want to make on the world? So I think that all of these areas, you know, whether it's through Think Circa or teachers are finding a different way to approach these things, teaching is becoming, you know, as we are learning to be more progressive in the field of education, we're learning to treat the student as a whole, to really look at things holistically, not only in, you know, their well-being, but also in our approach of what we're offering in education.
Okay. I love that. That sounds great. Just considering what you just said, I guess I have two questions. What do you mean by real world learning experiences? That being one. And then number two being, does this apply to all ages? Is this something, because it's pretty advanced stuff. I mean, you know, critically thinking about something and then thinking about what the counter, you know, what the counter is going to be to what you're thinking and considering who your audience is. I mean, this is some complex stuff. I mean, is this, you know, elementary, middle, high, you know, for example? So please.
Such a great question. Yeah, we actually work with grades 3 through 12 and higher education throughout the United States and actually a little bit even in China. And so when we say real world, you know, back in the day and during the Industrial Revolution, it was appropriate that different content areas were siloed because at some point you need to separate things out so you can really develop mastery around the subject of science or the subject of math or the subject of English history, for example. But in our daily lives, we're reading about things that are, you know, relevant to the world with a historical context. There are statistics, so it's bringing in mathematics. There are scientific discoveries that are informing it. And so in the real world, we don't actually separate things. It all merges together. Yeah. And in schools, we're artificially breaking them apart so that we can really master a subject. So there's a benefit to having expertise in a particular subject. But the way that education is kind of adapting to the real world is understanding actually these lines blur. And separating things out by grade level also is a little artificial. And so understanding that a framework such as this, you can continue to master over the years and into your adult life. And so, you know, as a teacher, I looked at a few things and Think Circa, definitely the lessons that are curated are very real world. They're very much, you know, we're constantly developing new lessons based on current events in society and including historical events. As a teacher, I specifically was using the approach of how can I use mathematics as a tool to better understand the world? So I'm not going to just learn probability for the sake of learning probability because it's on the standardized test. Although that is based on the way society has kind of deemed what's important, it is important. It is a high stakes exam. So like it or not, that does determine, you know, our acceptance rate into college. Mm-hmm. And then in the future, the type of job we get because of that. And so all of that's linked. And so not to kind of diminish the importance of that. Mm-hmm. But also, I'll give you a specific example. When I was teaching as a high school math teacher, when I was teaching the concept of probability, if you think back to probability, what's the chances? What are the chances you're going to X, Y, or Z? And so most of us were taught in kind of a way, for example, you know, what are the chances you're going to pick out a red jelly bean out of the jar? And tell me, have you ever looked at a jar of jelly beans and really considered you to yourself, what are the chances? What is the probability that I'm going to pick out a red jelly bean? Did that ever cross your mind when you were, you know, reaching into a jar?
Unless they're the weird tasting ones.
Probably not. And yeah, unless you're picking up the like the burnt flavored jelly belly, like weird one. And so what I kind of in my evolution of teaching, and I started my career in Los Angeles, inner city LA, as you mentioned, taught in Santiago de Chile, and then most recently here in San Diego at High Tech High in the Price School. And so in my teaching, you know, as a brand new teacher, a lot of times you're just surviving. You're like, okay, I got to learn this content. I got to just teach them, you know, so that they can pass the test, because the way that you're evaluated as a teacher is how, you know, what percentage of your students are gaining consistent mastery on an exam. But that doesn't necessarily reflect how aware of the world are these human beings? How are they as citizens? How do they contribute to the social climate of the classroom? So all of these, what we call soft skills, are not at all considered. And really it rewards that kind of regurgitation of information. And the way that Common Core has shifted is it really is trying to promote more of that critical thinking. But in my teaching practice, I went from, sure, what are the chances we're going to pull out a red jelly bean, to then shifting to how can I use that concept of probability and the concept of chances to better understand what's happening in society. And so I developed what I call the Privilege Project. And so what I started to understand more just in my development as a human being really is, based on certain identity markers, my probability of success in life kind of changes. And so, for example, being a woman of color, being heterosexual, being of a certain faith, all of these things contribute, being able-bodied, where I live, being a part of a certain socioeconomic status. And so these privileges or lack of privileges can affect my probability in life. Mm-hmm. And so I brought that into the classroom and had the students consider, okay, if you are, you know, of a certain race, gender, all these different factors, how is that going to affect your probability of success? And so students started to examine these things and they started to look at historical data. We started to look at current events. We started to look at research studies that were done that actually affect these areas. And so now when students are learning probability in my class, it's not just about jelly beans, which you're like, who could care less? Just, you know, I'll just pick out whatever jelly bean is there. But instead, they're starting to kind of have this paradigm shift of, wow, I actually now better understand my world. And so the students were looking at how does one's privilege affect their probability of success? And then, in my opinion, the more important part of that is, and how can I make an impact on that? So I think it's one thing to just use these tools of learning to better understand the world, but the next layer in the evolution of education and what I would hope and, you know, where I want to push teachers that I train, administrators that I train to move towards is, and so what? So now you understand that if you're of a certain, you know, racial background, you're at a disadvantage. Let's be honest. If you, you know, are a certain gender, you're at a disadvantage when it comes to statistically speaking, your probabilities of success. Okay. What can I do about it? And so we started to identify, well, all of us have some privilege. So even though I may not have male privilege, well, I certainly have able-bodied privilege. And so how can I use certain privileges that I have to make a difference, to stand up and advocate for those who don't have privilege in that area? And so now I can actually take what I'm learning in math class, which, you know, a lot of times seems disjointed from my life. Now I can understand the world better. So now I'm like, whoa, okay. I now understand that these patterns exist, not haphazardly, but there's actually a pattern here. And now I can be a change agent to make a difference. And I actually think that that's the direction that education needs to move. So I think that there is a kind of a paradigm shift in education needs to have a purpose in, you know, not just arbitrarily we're learning about these word problems or historical facts just to check the box and say we've learned it, but now we can better understand our world and we also have a sense of agency to change it. That's actually one of the biggest areas I see room for improvement in education. A lot of times students come in with this victim mentality. Poor me, you know, my life is really tough. And I think that I was a prime example of that. I felt like, what could I possibly do as a kid? And then once I got into, you know, college and even the workforce, I'm just one person. What could I possibly do? And then, you know, a lot of times life knocks you down. And so you think, well, if my life was only like this, I'd have more power. Maybe if I was a white heterosexual male, then I could change everything. And we've got to learn to unlearn some of those mentalities that we're, that we think we're stuck with, that we think that, you know, we don't, as one person, we can't make a difference, because you have enough of those kind of people in the world. And then that's when we get, you know, stagnant and nobody really wants to make that change because they think, well, I can't. And this really goes to the research around locus of control. So your locus of control can either be internal or external. Do I think the world around me makes a difference, kind of impacts and affects what happens in my life? Or is it an internal locus of control, which is I actually affect what happens in my life and have an impact externally to others? Now, what the research actually shows is that if you come from a low socioeconomic status background, you are, the chances are going to be that you have what's called an external locus of control. So you're so used to being told from society that because you maybe don't have money, look a certain way, you know, come from a certain part of the world or a certain family, you can't make a difference in your world unless you're a very small percentage of that population. Versus if you're someone who comes from money, you've kind of given that, you know, confidence that you dictate what happens in your world. Now, when we're looking at the achievement gap and we're wondering, well, what is it about, you know, why can't we close that achievement gap? A lot of times when we're looking at at-risk students, you know, we're looking for the new fancy method of teaching, you know, science just a little bit more effectively. And a lot of times we're actually missing the non-cognitive factors, which have to do with emotional intelligence, resilience, grit, and ultimately, you know, a sense of can I, you know, as a person of color or low socioeconomic status or someone whose parents have never been to college or whatever the identifier might be, can I actually make that impact on my life and then society at large?
Wow. That's a lot. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, because it seems like it really, it has a lot to do with self-confidence. Has you either expect to be a victim or you expect to have some kind of influence based on, you know, all the factors that you said, as well as, you know, how you were raised and, you know, the circle of influence your parents maybe had or the neighborhood that you lived in addition to your own, you know, skin tone or or, you know, all of those things, basically. But my question, I guess, like we were talking about before, how do we get this into the school system? Mm-hmm. How long does something like that take to actually put it in there to where, I guess the different, you know, powers that be accept it, mm-hmm. you know, how does that work as far as in your business? Because I'm assuming your company is an independent company.
Mm-hmm.
You're not run by the government in any way. Correct. So what does that battle look like as mm-hmm. far as, are you just like any other business trying to find clients mm-hmm. and reaching out to districts and superintendents and things like that? Mm-hmm. Or are there certain things that you have to do to be able to get this into the system and have the current system accept this new way of thinking about education?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Yeah, these are really great questions. So we do contract with specific schools and districts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the powers is that when you are working with a school or a district, leadership, you know, really is looking for how can I make a measurable impact?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so ultimately what it takes for there to be a measurable impact is a unified vision.
Mm-hmm.
Without unity, you know.
How do you test for this stuff, right? Is there a way to test and say these are the actual metrics of the impact of this new, it's actually making on the children?
Yeah. So at Think Circa, we actually do where we can internally, but then also externally, third party studies have been done on the results of what we're doing
mm-hmm.
to actually see that when you use our program with fidelity,
mm-hmm.
then we have a measurable impact that's greater than any other ed tech product that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're specifically getting 2 years on average, an average of 2 years of growth
mm-hmm.
on the state exams in reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so data can be collected when it comes to something around reading and writing
mm-hmm.
if the implementation. And so this is really what, you know, when we're looking at a school system, it takes a unity and vision, because if the implementation is just in a couple classes here or there, you know, and that was something I struggled with as a teacher. I was willing to have isolated amazingness in my classroom, but there wasn't necessarily this consistency across the board and this, you know, overarching unity. And so I find that just that word unity has been so powerful, obviously, not just in a classroom, a school level, a district level, but really we can see in a community, a family, and the world at large. And so that's one of the things that we work to do is help being that consultant with the and that collaborator with the district to help them kind of see how do we actually connect all those dots, bring everybody together, kind of get around a common vision. Everybody wants their students to be successful. And ultimately, why do we want our students to be successful? We want them to make an impact on the world, to actually create a better world for our future. And not just kind of continue the way that we're going, because ultimately we're going to fall apart at this rate, you know, and the trajectory that we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work at that around specifically reading, writing, critical thinking, speaking, and listening.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to touch back on emotional intelligence that you were talking about.
Please.
So I actually did research for part of my doctorate on emotional intelligence, and my work was centered around supporting at-risk students with emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Through my research, I found out that actually the majority of teacher education programs around the United States don't at all incorporate any emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where it is a little bit of a buzzword is at the elementary level. So folks kind of assume that once you're in middle school, you've figured it out. And just to clarify, when we're talking about emotional intelligence, we're talking about someone's ability to perceive and understand and manage their own emotions and the emotions of others. Now think about in our workplaces amongst adults. I wouldn't say that we can say with confidence that people have a very high EQ or emotional intelligence. And so to think that we've done a sufficient job at the elementary level and that we should just let it go as we get older is a grave oversight. We do see some kind of some sprinklings of people really adopting this idea that we've got to develop our students beyond the cognitive factor. So beyond just new techniques to teach, you know, particular subject in math. And I'll give you a really kind of salient quote that I put in my dissertation. It was a quote that a student said to me my first year teaching. So just to paint the scene for you. My first year teaching inner city Los Angeles, the school had about a 50% graduation rate. So if you think about, you know, 1,000 freshmen, it was a huge school, 1,000 freshmen would come in each year, and only about 500 would cross that stage at the end of the year. And that was due to just a lot of different factors. But to give you a little bit more to paint that picture, in my first year teaching, I had mostly freshmen, and I had 55 students in a classroom with only 35 desks. Oh, wow. So, you know, when you came into my classroom and you saw the students would be sharing desks, and a lot of these students were in cruiser games, and a lot of times in rival cruiser games, and now suddenly they're sitting side by side sharing a seat, sharing a desk. Yeah. And when I asked the counselor how, you know, I looked at my roster, I started crying. Poor me. I was like 22-year-old teacher, and I was just like, what am I going to do? And the counselor said to me, don't worry, most of them will drop out. And so when we're going in, wow, already setting the, wow, stage for that kind of attrition rate, and really setting our students up for failure, because that's what we think of them. Mm. Obviously didn't turn out so well. Mm. We have 3 lockdowns in the first 3 months of me teaching. There were 2 stabbings and a shooting, and one of my students got stabbed in the head. I also had 8 of my students get pregnant. And as I mentioned to you, most of my students were freshmen, and they would say to me, Miss, you're getting so old, you better hurry and have kids. And so that was just very kind of ingrained there.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, just to kind of give you an idea of that climate, one of my students in my first year teaching, she came into the class and she said, Miss, how do you expect me to care about the Pythagorean theorem when I almost got raped on my way to school? So what am I supposed to do with that as a teacher? I mean, yeah, you win.
Yeah.
You shouldn't care. Yeah. You've got bigger problems.
Throw the math book in the trash.
Right.
Let's figure this other thing.
Right. And so what I decided, you know, that really inspired my journey into educational leadership, which is, you know, the field that I'm really passionate about now, is there's something we're missing in education. We're really focused on mastering the cognitive piece of it, but there's that non-cognitive piece that's really critical. And if we don't get that piece right, you know, we're going to continue to lose students and just... And I would say not even students, but really if you look at the state of the world, the number of people who might identify with suffering from anxiety, depression, loneliness, these are all words that are so, you know, just pervasive in our society these days. So I'd say this extends far beyond the classroom. But in the classroom, we have the ability to make that difference, you know, at such a large scale. They say that it's, you know, easier to build or raise strong boys than to repair broken men.
Yeah.
And so such a big responsibility in the field of education. But as I noticed that emotional intelligence was just such an important piece of this puzzle, if not the most important, because if you're already coming into a classroom feeling threatened, feeling uneasy because you got jumped on the way to school, you almost got raped on the way to school, home life is less than ideal, you're dealing with, you know, whatever else that you're dealing with, you cannot even access the neocortex, which is the responsible part, the part of your brain that's responsible for the logical thought or the rational thinking. So it's actually our limbic system that first deals with the emotional, the flight or fight response. Mm-hmm. That, you know, in our evolution as a human species, that was the part of the brain that was developed first. Mm-hmm. Then the neocortex.
Safety. Yeah, yeah.
And so if we're not addressing that piece, then, you know, we can't continue to evolve education as it needs to not just respond to the needs of the future, but I really believe in actually creating a new future, a new civilization for humankind, not just repairing or reacting to what's not working in our world. And so those are some of the areas that I researched. And, you know, without a doubt, that was, I did a qualitative study that looked at students who were, quote unquote, at risk. And so we define that by students who are low socioeconomic status, students of color, and students whose family members had not gone to college. So that was kind of how that was defined in education. Mm-hmm. And so looking at students who had specifically failed math multiple years in a row. What's going on? Because after 9 years of teaching, there was not a single student I didn't feel like I could teach math to. I could teach math to anybody. It doesn't matter if you don't speak English. It doesn't matter if you're a student with special needs. It doesn't matter if you, you know, whatever your background is with math. I could teach you math. I could teach you how to have a growth mindset, and which teaches that the more you persist through something, you can learn anything.
Yeah.
And then you can learn math.
Yeah.
And so what I found through my study, and, you know, I studied a wide range of students, some who were, you know, who were in gangs, some who were not, some folks who had gone through all sorts of kind of paths of life. And every single one of the students that I interviewed broke down crying. And that showed me that this was something really deep rooted. It was something that, you know, in their earliest years of education, actually, I was just reviewing my study, and all of the participants in the study, up to about grade 4 or 5, they loved math. And then something happened around grade 5 where they started to create an identity about themselves that they're not good at this. And then that persisted through life. And so they started to lose confidence. They started to lose trust in their ability to do something. They also started to lose trust in the person who was trying to teach them that concept. And so what these students had told me was that it actually had to do more with the lack of connection to the other human being than it had anything to do with the subject. That they felt threatened by the environment, and they were hoping and almost crying inside for that new math teacher at the beginning of each year, please help me regain confidence that this is something that I can even accomplish. And so that taps into something beyond math class.
Yeah.
It's actually just this desire for connection, this desire for love, acceptance, and to be able to be vulnerable and still be accepted for that vulnerability. And these are some of the aspects of education that we are addressing. Some schools are addressing through meditation. How can you lower your cortisol levels, your anxiety, so that you can, you know, if you can bring those cortisol levels down, you can then start to access your neocortex, your thinking brain. Some are doing it through yoga. You know, just other sorts of kind of counseling practices, group discussions, you know, having a safe space to talk about these things. So there are kind of small pockets, but we have a very long way to go in terms of revolutionizing the system of education, because by and far, this is not a common practice. They're really kind of isolated. And there are some charter schools that this is, you know, a core piece of what they do. But in terms of kind of the public education system, it's still lacking big time.
Yeah. And, you know, most of our kids are in public school in some way, shape, or form. I have a question that I wasn't necessarily planning to ask, but do you, in your experience, do you feel like you got, even especially in the LA schools, do you feel like you got enough support from the parents? Do you feel like it was almost like you, like maybe you as the teacher and the parents as the parents, maybe weren't on the same page, or maybe had different expectations or goals or whatever the case? And what role did that play?
You know, I think ultimately it really depended on the parent. It's hard to kind of make a general statement. Sure, there were definitely cases of parents who didn't really understand. For example, with the Privilege Project I mentioned to you, where I did several different projects, another one was around being an entrepreneur and teaching my students how to use math and how to create your own business and things like that. I had my students write in class, do public speaking in my class. Yeah. And I did have some parents who'd say, you know, can you just stick to the numbers? Mm-hmm. Don't bring in the real world. Don't make my kid think too much about these social ills of society. Just stick to the numbers. So I think that there was some resistance there, but I think generally parents were supportive when they saw a teacher who really cared about their child, when they saw that I was personally committed and invested in their success, not only to get good scores and to get into college, but also to just evolve their thinking about the world, about their identity, how they fit into it. And so we have a ways to go as well in involving the parent community, in looking at them as partners, and really collaborating there. And one of the difficulties there is parent to parent, you have vastly different kind of backgrounds and expectations. Also, culture plays a big role. Okay. So in certain cultures, parents are very much just respect the teacher, whatever the teacher says is law. Mm-hmm. And then there are other cultures where, you know, I'm going to fight for my child's rights and I'm going to kind of look at the teacher as, you know, they've question got to everything. Question everything that they're doing. Yeah. So it really, I would say, depended on the family, the culture, sometimes socioeconomic status would play a role in it. Mm-hmm. Also location in the world. So when I taught in Chile, I taught at a, you know, kind of an elite private school, and a lot of the parents were diplomats, or they were kind of the highest socioeconomic status of the local Chilean population. Mm-hmm. And then at the charter schools that I taught at, you know, here in San Diego, again, just a lottery system brought students from all over San Diego. So just a huge diversity.
Mm, nice. And so you talked a little bit about entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And so in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, it seems like our schools traditionally kind of teach our kids to become employees of some sort, to go be a cog in this big machine. What do you think about implementing more education on the skills required to kind of be more independent and take that entrepreneurial route, or even a balance of the both? I'm not saying that we need to just change it all and go a totally different route, but just incorporating a little bit more of that, I don't know if I'm explaining myself. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question, and I've evolved my thinking around this as a practitioner in the field of education. Just to give you a little background, I mentioned I did what's called the business project. So as you're learning this concept of quadratics, you may remember it from algebra, but it was this concept, or really a quadratic, maybe you remember a parabola, that U-shaped graph. Most of us forget if we don't, you know, continue on to study math.
We're not using it, yeah.
But what's funny about that U-shaped graph is actually when you chart it, the vertex, or that point at the very top could be used for profit maximization.
Okay.
So when we're thinking about starting a business, you have a product, you have a service, and you obviously want to gain some profits out of it. And so I developed a project for my students who essentially they developed their own product or service. They went out into the world and had to collect data to see, would you buy it? How much would you pay for it? So they did the market research, seeing, was this something that people needed? How much would they pay for it? They learned all about linear regressions, quadratic regressions. So they learned all the mathematics, again, mathematics as a tool to better understand your world. And now what are you going to do with it? So that was kind of my path in education, and a path I think many educators could take if given that freedom in the school system and so on. And so essentially what the students did was they would then create a prototype of their product. They would put together a business portfolio to say, this is how much money I need to start my business. This is what, you know, it would take. This would be my revenue. These would be my costs. This would be my profit. And using that vertex to find the optimum price to sell their product at.
Mm-hmm.
I then invited entrepreneurs and others just in the community in San Diego or wherever I was doing the project to come in and be a part of our pitch competition. And so those entrepreneurs would come in and judge. They would give, you know, feedback because that's what they do for a living. I also had some venture capitalists who would serve on that panel. So they knew exactly, you know, what it took.
Mm-hmm.
And these students would, you know, rehearse and get up and present, and they had just, you know, a very short pitch, and ultimately the judges made their decision on who, you know, whose product was kind of going to survive the tough world out there. And I would raise money again from just different stakeholders in the community who were interested in supporting these students. And so I'd have a pot of money, and the winners got the money to actually start their project, their business. So all of my students became little entrepreneurs. And I did it for students as young as eighth grade and then up through grade 12. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over time I learned, okay, money is one piece of it, but now you also need mentorship. So my last iteration of the project was having the entrepreneur actually, I had some entrepreneurs who signed up to be mentors. So would mentor these students in the execution of the plan that they proposed and advise them throughout that. And so I really believe, you know, that when students see that sense of agency, that I can be a leader. And it doesn't have to be in a traditional sense of like being up on a podium and giving a speech leader, but starting a company that I can make a difference. I saw just kind of light bulbs go off for students. There were students who were really checked out of math class, but now when they're seeing I can make money by learning math, it changes everything. And I would say the students who grow up in a low socioeconomic status are actually particularly business savvy, because sometimes they've come with duffel bags with Cheetos, Chamoy, and Coke. And was that you?
That was me.
And look at you now as an entrepreneur. So I'm not surprised, because they have that kind of ingrained in them as a kid of hustle and that survival and that, you know, think outside the box. I got to make some money. And so these kids, I remember even to the point where some of the kids were baking cupcakes and like, Miss, you want to buy one? Or, you know, cutting up some watermelon, like, Miss, how much for some, you know? So
that's awesome. I used to sell them on the school bus on the way to school.
Exactly. And so how can we harness some of these things that might be looked at from the outside world as a deficit? Like, why are you hustling for money as a kid? How can I capitalize on that, harness that power, that beauty, that asset you have, and help you do it in a way that you can scale it, that you can actually change the trajectory of not just your life, but your family's life? And talking about parent support, I mean, the emotions some of those parents had, they were so excited that their kids were learning how to do this, that they would call me or send me an email and they would just say, our whole family is behind this business and we're all supporting to this work. So I think, you know, that there are things out there being done. I'm sure I'm not the only one, you know, looking at this. Think Circa also in its way of creating critical thinkers as opposed to just regurgitators is very much that entrepreneurial mindset. But I want to just add a caveat here that to be an entrepreneur or to, you know, want to start an organization, start a business, make money and all that without seeing your interconnectedness to the planet, to the people around you, again, is actually just very self-serving and continues that perpetual cycle of feeding the ego.
Yeah.
When I ask my students, you know, why do you want to do well in school? Well, they want to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
What does being successful mean? And a lot of times, traditionally, it means making money, having accumulating a lot of kind of material wealth, material goods that others can admire, and having a job that makes a lot of money. So again, it comes back to these earthly possessions.
It's almost something that was created by somebody else, and they just kind of accepted it, that this is the American dream.
Absolutely. So I think that having that socially conscious perspective, almost a spiritual sense that we're not just this body and I'm not just a job or, you know, a title, that I'm something beyond this. And I recently heard a podcast from a physician, I believe his name was Zach Bush, and he talks about working in the ICU. And what he does is, you know, He's the person who attempts to revive and resuscitate people who are clinically pronounced as dead. So, you know, they might lose them during surgery and he's going to try to revive them and bring them back. And what he mentions on this podcast is that you know, 100% of the people that he brings back to life after they've slipped into the other side, whatever that might be, 100% of the people say, why did you bring me back? And he's like, wait, what do you mean? You know, because he's feeling proud. I just saved your life. And again, that has to do with, well, how do we define life? And why are we assuming that this is all there is to life and this physical existence? And so he at first is a little offended. And then he's like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, and they all describe the same thing when they slip into the other side. They describe it as a place where for the first time they've felt complete acceptance, unconditional love. He explains it as just some of the things we might hear stories or see in the movies or from religious scripture, that there's, you know, kind of this light, beams of light, and that really they understand that we are so much more than the physical existence that we've learned to admire and obsess over in this world, but that we're actually something beyond that. And he describes it as they describe it as light, love, acceptance. And whether you call that a soul, whether you call it energy, whether you call it a spirit, this concept, and I'm just going to use spirituality to give us some language around it, but that key piece, I think, is one of the biggest things that's missing from the foundation of our kind of what's driving us in education. Because what's driving us right now is actually much more related to the ego. I want to be successful so that my name is plastered everywhere, so that I leave a legacy. Well, you know, that's different than saying I want to leave an impact on the world because I want to help others. I want to make a difference in that way versus I want to do it so that my name is branded on it. So when I pass on, you know, everybody will remember who so-and-so was. So I think that's one of the key pieces, the underlying pieces that in some ways we're trying to bring back. Whether it's through being, you know, more socially conscious in what we're doing, whether it's, you know, some educational systems are really looking around Mother Nature and the way that things work together and how we can really contribute to the environment and help mitigate some of these issues. We can continue to tiptoe around the subject, but I understandably so becomes so political because we're associating spirituality with religion. And religion, unfortunately, has become more of a culture and cultural divide, you know, as we associate religion with, you know, specific practices or, you know, specific, you know, ways of speaking or foods we eat or some of these very cultural things, as opposed to what these people describe when they pass on as being these beings of light. They didn't say the Christians were over here and the Muslims were over here and the Jews were over here and the atheists. Well, the atheists didn't even enter this realm of light.
They were in this dark room in the back.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, there needs to be a shift in consciousness and elevation of consciousness, not just in the field of education. It is a nice place to start, though, but just as a society, you know, at large, that when I'm seeing another human being, instead of putting my head down, putting my earphones in, walking past, and acting like they don't exist, recognizing that there's something beyond the shell that we have that binds us all, that's the same amongst all.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I could talk about this all day long. I really could. Out of respect for your time, we're past it because we started later, but we're at about an hour, but I wanted to see if you could share with people, where can they learn more about all of this that you're talking about? How can maybe they follow you or follow your company or you know, other organizations that are thinking progressively when it comes to education, beyond sharing ideas and all of that? I want to try to share, you know, real stuff or tools where people can go and actually keep going. If they've found value in our discussion here, maybe they can keep reading about it or learning about it or hearing about it. So maybe you can share, where can people look for you online, or where can people look for your company online, or where everything, but just to share with some of the folks out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can easily be reached at my email address. So it's monakiani19@gmail.com. So monakiani19@gmail.com. Think Circa can be contacted through me, or just think the word think, THINK, and then Circa is CERCA. So thinkcirca.com, and there are ways to contact us through there. I will say, though, as we're looking at kind of a socially conscious and kind of a spiritual foundation to education and elevating the conversation around that, I think the main thing that's really informed my concept of this is being a Baha'i. And the Baha'i faith is a worldwide religion that believes in the unity of all world religions. And we see the interconnectedness of all the different faiths, as opposed to kind of you have to pick and choose, but that this is all part of the divine unfolding plan. And there's some really cool things that the Baha'is worldwide are doing to address this issue of spiritual education in tandem to our formal education system, since, again, it is highly political. And so some examples of ways that people, if this resonates, of this idea of bringing this kind of spiritual awareness to inform everything you're learning, so that the tools can help inform, you know, how do you put the spiritual reality into practice to make an impact on the world and really transform our civilization. The Baha'is are, you know, again, worldwide, but there are two specific programs. One is the children's classes. So we have children's virtues classes. And again, you can go to any country in the world and look up Baha'i, BAHA'I, or just go to Baha'i.org. And you can look up the community there. And there are in many neighborhoods having these people come together to look at virtues. How do we develop patience, love, compassion? How do we look at, as a child, how can you look at your obstacles as a way to grow? Tests and difficulties as something that's going to make you stronger. So I think it's those components to education that we're not quite capitalizing on in the school system. And so currently you can get it in other arenas, and this is one example. So we have children's classes. We also have something called the Junior Youth Spiritual Empowerment Program. And specifically what those groups are, and you can Google that again in any community, what those groups are striving to do is to actually look at, what is my spiritual reality, that I am more than this, you know, bag of bones. And then how can I have an impact on my community that's positive? So these are, you know, folks from the ages of 12 to 15 who are looking at their community around them and finding a need, what needs to change. And they're spending, you know, a few hours on the weekend every week going out and actually doing service for their community. Not because they're a part of a certain religion and their religion says, well, you have, that's just what you have to do. Not because they're gaining community service hours for it and it just looks good on your resume or your college application. And not just because you're being forced to do it as a punishment, but because their heart calls to it, that they see that their purpose is higher than just serving their ego.
They care about the community.
They care about the community, and they see themselves as connected, that those beings of light is as real to them as my arm being a part of the same body as another arm is part of the same. And so if this is hurting, my body feels it. So that is kind of that's our spiritual reality. And so there are programs. Those are just a couple to name that are, you know, worldwide. And then here locally in San Diego, I just got introduced to a program called the Social Fabric Initiative that University of San Diego puts on. Very similar concept, where the students spend their summers dedicating their time to service. And really seeing the value of service. The college puts it on, but these are actually designed for middle and high school students and help to be put on by mentors. So those are just a few. And, you know, Googling Social Fabric Initiative at University of San Diego, those are, you know, a couple of resources. And again, you can always reach out to me and I can help plug them in.
Awesome. Your email again, MonaKiani19 1919@gmail.com.
Yes.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending this time with me and educating me.
Yeah.
This whole industry and what we're doing. So folks, I hope you got a lot of value out of this. Again, Dr. Mona Chiani, this is Gordon Chavez. Check it out at gordonchavez.tv. The recording is going to go up there on YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys have a great day.
Thanks so much, Gordon.